Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Americans tip more than people anywhere else in the world. Each year, diners in the U.S. hand over some $42 billion in tips at restaurants, which employ around 2.6 million servers. And for many of these restaurant workers, the generosity of strangers makes up the bulk of their income. And it's not just at restaurants. We tip more kinds of workers than the rest of the world as well. 31 service professions involve tipping in the U.S. You can compare that to 27 in, say, Canada or India, 15 in the Netherlands, 5 to 10 throughout Scandinavia, 4 in Japan, and 0 in Iceland. Tipping isn't just a custom. It's built into our law so that there's actually a lower minimum wage for tipped workers. The federal government guarantees tipped workers just $2.13 an hour, a number that has not changed since 1991. Servers at restaurants use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and are three times as likely to live in poverty. Now, there are states and localities that have considerably higher tipped minimums. California law mandates at least $8, and San Francisco has the highest minimum tipped wage at $10.74 an hour. But with a national campaign on to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour, there's also debate over whether the tipped minimum should get a boost as well, or whether it should be eliminated altogether. In this hour of Your Call, we're going to talk about the push for a higher tipped minimum wage, and we're also going to explore some more fundamental questions about the American approach to tipping. How did it become such a widespread practice? Does it provide an incentive for good service, or make for an unequal and maybe even exploitive relationship between workers, customers, and employers? If you work in an industry where tipping is the norm, maybe you run a business where workers receive tips, we want to hear your perspective. And if you are someone whose experience of tipping is simply giving them, we want to have you join the conversation as well. If tipping went away, do you think that we would lose something valuable? The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment at yourcallradio.org. That's our website. Joining us for the conversation this hour are Saru Jayaraman. She is co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, and they have a Living Off Tips campaign that's advocating for the Miller-Harkin Fair Minimum Wage Act, and that would raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour over the next 3 years, and it would raise the tipped minimum wage so that it would be 70% of the regular minimum wage. Well above where it is now. Saru, great to have you back on the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, so good to have you with us for this conversation. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking with Jay Porter, and he is a restaurant owner who has actually experimented with abolishing tips. We're going to hear why he did that and what the results were for workers, for customers, and for him as someone running the business. But we want to start the conversation with someone who can give us a longer view of tipping in the United States, and that's Andrew Haley. He is an associate professor of American Cultural History at the University of Southern Mississippi and author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants and the Rise of the American Middle Class, 1880 to 1920. Andrew, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good morning, Matt.
Yeah. And so I want to this book that you wrote about restaurants in the American middle class covers this range from 1880 to 1920. And I think a little known bit of American history is that this is a time when tipping was actually something really controversial, that people really debated whether or not this was a good practice. Take us back a bit and, you know, give us a thumbnail schedule. How did tipping come to the United States? I understand it was originally a European practice. And why it became such a contentious issue?
Tipping in the United States before the Civil War was fairly rare. Americans might tip a servant or a waiter at a restaurant for really exceptional service, but it was not something that was the kind of typical practice. Most Americans believed that it was a European habit, that the wealthy had picked up the habit when they were visiting their friends in Europe, and they would tip the household servants. And so they brought this tradition, custom, back to the United States, and they tipped servers in restaurants. And then after the Civil War, this practice became fairly regular. Now, this was at elite restaurants. These were very fancy restaurants. They were French restaurants. They served French food. And the wealthy went to these restaurants in order to flatter their egos and make a statement about their social status. And so tipping became a part of the way they asserted themselves and asserted their claim to being a kind of American aristocracy. But it really becomes controversial, as you pointed out, in the 1880s and after. And that's when restaurants are becoming somewhat more democratic. In particular, the middle class are beginning to dine out at restaurants. And the middle class are going to these restaurants, and they are hoping for the same service that the wealthy are getting, but they don't have the resources to tip as generously as the wealthy are tipping, and so they feel they're constantly getting poorer service. And when that happens, they begin to complain. In the late 19th and early 20th century, I don't think you could pick up a magazine or a newspaper and read it for a month or two without finding an article complaining about the practice of tipping.
So this was really, and actually some states were actually banning tipping early in the 20th century.
Yes. In the early 20th century, about six states banned the practice. Another four states at least consider bans on the practice. The regulations against tipping were never very effective. It was largely believed that people tipped anyways, and states put no effort into enforcing them, and most of those bans were rescinded in the 1920s.
So most of the objections were at that time were really coming not from the side of people working in restaurants or in other tipped kind of professions, but from the side of people who were the middle class people who were the customers.
Yes, I think that's true. The middle class customer felt cheated. They felt somewhat at sea in the restaurant. The menus were often in French. They didn't understand what was going on. They were very dependent upon the waiters for quality service, and they felt that the wealthier folks were getting better service than they were. But they often couched those complaints in language that supported the waiters. And so during this kind of progressive era, many of the anti-tipping advocates would talk about what waiting did to servers. They called it a bribe. They compared it to slavery. And they said that in a democracy, no one should have to be servile, that you should get paid for the work you did, not for being obsequious.
So I want to bring in Sara in this conversation, but before I do that, let's fast forward a little bit. By 1926, all of these tip bans were out of the way. They'd all been overturned one way or the other. And this really became entrenched. And where do we get to the point where we have this separate minimum wage for people in certain job categories where tips are received and where, in a lot of ways, you know, the tipped wages came to replace people's hourly wage?
Yeah, as late as 1947, 68% of Americans approved of tipping, but, you know, a significant minority were still opposed to tipping. But by 1947, pretty much everyone tipped. About 96% of restaurant goers, regardless of whether they approved of tipping, were tipping. And in the 1930s, as part of the New Deal legislation, a minimum wage was established. That minimum wage law, though, didn't cover certain classes of workers. It didn't cover farm workers. It didn't cover household servants. And it didn't cover waiters and waitresses. So there wasn't a minimum wage for waiters of any sort until 1966, when the minimum wage law was reformed under the President Johnson's Great Society program.
So it was actually that lower minimum wage was actually a step forward over what had been there before.
It was.
So we're just hearing from Andrew Haley. He's associate professor of American cultural history at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's done a lot of research on the history of restaurants and tipping in the United States. Also with us is Sara Jayaraman. She's co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United organization, and they have a Living Off Tips campaign that is really trying to give people a sense of what it's like to work in areas where tips are the great majority of your compensation. So, Sara, I wanted to bring you in. So you've been hearing some of this history from Andrew. Talk about how this is working now and what this kind of separated area for the tipped employees, what that in our law, what that means for people's livelihoods.
Yes, and thank you so much for focusing on this really important topic. I just wanted to modify a little bit my bio. I am the co-founder and co-director of Rock United, the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. I also teach at UC Berkeley. I'm an academic. I teach in the Goldman School of Public Policy. And I've written a book also called Behind the Kitchen Door on this very subject, on the restaurant industry and the 10 million workers in America that work in this industry. And I want to add a little bit to the history, actually.
Great.
We've done a decade of research on these issues. And, you know, beyond 1960, what we did see in the 60s, I should say, what we did see was we did see that lower wage, even though it was lower for tipped workers, being pegged at a finite percentage, you know, to the overall minimum wage. In other words, it continued to rise. Where we saw it change was in the early 90s. Here's what happened. So the restaurant industry right now is the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It's over 10 million workers. 1 in 12 Americans right now works in the restaurant industry, but it happens to be the absolute lowest paying employer in the United States statistically. And when I often say that, people say, oh, well, that's probably fast food jobs, when in fact, of the 7 lowest paying jobs in America that are restaurant jobs. So every year the U.S. Department of Labor puts out the 10 lowest paying jobs in America. Every year we win the award. 7 of the 10 are restaurant jobs. And every year of those 7 lowest paying jobs, at least 3 or 4 are tipped professions. And so you've got the largest and fastest growing industry in America proliferating the absolute lowest paying jobs. And it is entirely due to the power of the industry lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, and which has been named the 10th most powerful lobbying group in Congress, and which back in 1996 was led by a man named Herman Cain, who later ran or tried to run for president on the Republican ticket. Now, under Herman Cain's leadership, the other NRA struck a deal with Congress, saying that they wouldn't oppose a very tiny increase in the overall minimum wage as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stayed frozen forever. And so while you've seen a rise, you know, from the 60s to 91, which was the last time the tip minimum wage went up in the United States, what we saw was a freezing of the minimum wage because of this deal struck between the Restaurant Association and Congress. And we've seen that same deal just over the last 12 years that I've been working on this issue. I've seen that same deal struck between the Restaurant Association and state legislatures in 43 states in the United States. So California is actually one of 7 states in the United States that has the same wage for tipped workers. It's California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska all have the same wage for tipped and non-tipped workers, and they're actually faring better in on every measure, from restaurant sales per capita, from server occupational growth, to overall job growth in the restaurant industry. Those 7 states are faring better than the 43 states that have between $2 and $5 an hour for tipped workers, and that's entirely due to this political deal that's been struck. Now, how does the Restaurant Association get away with essentially saying, we shouldn't have to pay our own workers' wages, you, the customers, should, because when you earn a wage of between $2 and $5 an hour in 2014, that means your wage is so low, it goes entirely to taxes, and you live completely off of your tips. And here's where I come to the other modification I'd make in the introduction you gave of me. We're not actually fighting at this time to raise the tip minimum wage. We're fighting to eliminate the lower tip minimum wage altogether in every state across the United States. If California and 6 other states can do it successfully, so can everybody else. And here's the kicker, you know, how does the Restaurant Association get away with this? They paint the picture of a guy who works at a fancy steakhouse in San Francisco, says, oh, he earns $18 an hour, he's doing just fine, when in fact 70% of tipped workers in America are women, women who work at IHOP and Denny's and Olive Garden, and there are Denny's and Olive Gardens in San Francisco, and these women across America earn a median wage, including tips of $8.70 an hour. And it isn't just servers we're talking about. It's bussers and runners and bartenders, all of whom collectively earn poverty wages as a median wage across the board, including tips. There are, of course, those fine dining servers who do great, right, but they're a very, very, very small minority. The vast majority of these women are not only living incredibly precarious, economically unstable lives, but our research has shown they are also subject to literally and statistically the worst sexual harassment of any industry in the United States, because they must please the customer. At all times, they must sell themselves to please the customer.
And we should talk about that's one of the effects of this kind of tip-based system that people who don't work in restaurants may not be aware of, that they may not think about what that dynamic is. I just want to cut in to invite listeners to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or go to our website, yourcallradio.org, where you can leave a comment there. If you are someone who works in restaurants or another tipped industry, and you want to talk about what those dynamics are for you and how you would like to see things changed, if you would like to see them changed, that's the number to call, 866-798-8255. And Sara, we actually got a comment from a listener who called who couldn't stand the line. He said he wanted to share a common saying of restaurant workers. It should be that you have to work in a restaurant before you're allowed to eat at a restaurant. And you're someone who is so close to this, so deeply involved, and knows people working in these situations. Can you just explain how the system works at restaurants in terms of tipping and sharing of people? We hear different things, and I just want you to spell it out for us.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you tip your server, you're not actually just tipping your server. Your server is sharing that tip with a number of other workers, the bussers, the runners, the bartenders, sometimes the hosts, all too often illegally management. We find that at least 1 in 4 to 5 workers in America who are tipped are forced to illegally share tips with management. So it is split among numerous people, and then, of course, in most states, as I said, even that minuscule portion that's split among so many people is counted against your wages and given essentially as a credit to the employer. And I just really want to clarify.
Explain that part. I'm curious. I mean, in terms of that, we have this lower minimum wage in a lot of places for tipped workers, but there's supposed to be some way that if they're not. Talk about how that works.
That's right. So basically, the idea is that if your tips for every hour that you work do not make up the difference between the lower minimum wage of $2.13 an hour and the regular minimum wage of $7.25, again, not in California, but in most other states, then the employer is supposed to make sure to make up that difference in wages. Now, we've surveyed over 6,000 restaurant workers across America. There's only been one instance that I've heard of an employer actually going back and counting hour by hour and making sure that tips make up the difference. In fact, the U.S. Department of Labor has said that there's an 83% violation rate with regard to tips and wages, that employers almost never make sure that tips make up the difference. One thing I want to be very, very clear about to your listeners, we are not at this moment advocating for complete elimination of tips as we know it. That is not what we're advocating for, because for all the reasons I've just stated, the poverty wages, I mean, it's not like $7.25 or $8 in California or $9 is a living wage anyway. Tips are still incredibly necessary to bring people to what is even close to a professional wage. And I think that's the key word for me. How can we make sure these folks are treated like professionals? For us, a step in the right direction would be to make sure that they at least have a base wage in addition to their tips. That's not a lower wage. That's not discounted simply because they're getting tips. If you think about any other profession in America, right? A doctor, a lawyer, a teacher. Can you imagine a gift that you give to your doctor being discounted from his or her salary, or an apple given to a teacher by a student being discounted from his or her salary? It would be unheard of. It's only this professional. Of course, there are other tipped professions, but it's primarily the restaurant industry that gets away with this extraordinary boondoggle of saying we practically shouldn't pay our workers at all because customers do. We should get a credit. We should get an extra credit because customers pay our workers for us, which is just counterintuitive, really, to what tips are meant to be. Tips were never meant to be wages. They're intended to be on top of a wage. And I will say, until we get to a day where we're closer to Norway or other countries that pay restaurant workers a professional wage, and Norway it's $25 an hour, until we get to that day, tips are necessary to bring servers and bussers up to a professional standard. But ultimately, we need to obviously treat them as the professionals that they are.
So, Andrew Haley, we're going to be letting you go in just a moment. I just wanted to get some final thoughts from you about where this the kind of American approach to tipping, and I think one thing we'll definitely be talking about in the second half hour when we bring on Jay Porter, who's a restaurateur, who's actually kind of experimented with abolishing tips in a restaurant that he owned, where, you know, the practices of, I mean, I think that some of what Sara is describing and this whole idea of, oh, you know, I have this assumption that the person who's serving me probably isn't getting a living wage, isn't getting what they should. Therefore, that's part of what motivates people to tip and their sense of obligation toward that. I mean, if you could talk about how that developed in the United States and how that compares to other countries.
Sure. Well, in the United States, like at Jay Porter's restaurant, there have been experiments where restaurants banned tipping. Most of these experiments were local and small scale. And as the restaurant industry became an industry, particularly after 1919 and the formation of the National Restaurant Association and other organizations, those kind of experiments in abolishing tipping disappeared. And part of the issue was, as Saru says about today, is that there was a perception that waiters could do quite well with their tips. And so there were often stories about these millionaire waiters who had saved up their tips throughout their life, who became millionaires. And now, probably most of these stories were apocryphal. Certainly, they referred to male waiters and waiters who worked in the most exclusive restaurants. But that helped to suppress some of the antagonism towards, some of the anger towards tipping in the United States. And so in the kind of post-World War II era, tipping has largely been accepted. Americans are considered some of the largest tippers in the world, and so we do it voluntarily, and we do it eagerly. But it's also because we have kept the price because we demand as consumers that the price of going out to eat is ridiculously low. And I think this is where a historian can add a little bit of perspective. In 1900, if you went out to a nice restaurant, a really nice restaurant, it would cost about 2 weeks of your wages. Today, it costs about a single day of your wages. Our expectations are that we can go out to eat and that we don't have to worry about the cost of dining. We don't have to worry about what the waiter is or the waitress is receiving in pay. And we certainly don't want to think about the dishwasher in the back room.
Andrew Haley, thank you so much for being with us. Really good perspective. And I want to take a quick call before we go to our break from Lynn in Oakland. Lynn, welcome to your call.
Hello. I've got a couple points to make. First of all, I was a waitress at one point in my life when I worked my way through college. I'm now lucky enough to, I'm a lawyer and I can support myself. But I can tell you, first of all, right off, food service professionals do not make a living wage. They're unable to support themselves on tips. And there's a huge variance between the amount of tips depending on what restaurant you might work at and who you are, you know, the variance in who the people you're serving tend to be. But what I wanted to say is I think everyone's looking at tipping in the wrong way. Everyone deserves a living wage, a minimum wage. And on top of that, if you provide extraordinary service, you leave a tip. I always leave 20% across the board, whether I get good service or not, because I feel like that makes up for the wage that this person is lacking. But I just think the way we look at tips needs to be revisited.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for calling in. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Holly Kernan. We're talking about the customs and economics and politics of tipping on the program today. On with us is Sara Jayaraman. She's co-founder, co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, also an academic at UC Berkeley and author of Behind the Kitchen Door. And joining us in this first half hour was Andrew Haley, associate professor of American Cultural History at the University of Southern Mississippi. Andrew, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Your Call today. And we will be back with more of the program right after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a program that relies on engaged listeners. You can join our conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. Coming up at 11 o'clock, just 30 minutes away from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. At noon today, This American Life with Ira Glass, and then at 1 o'clock, snap judgment.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about the customs, economics, and politics of tipping. I'm Matt Martin, filling in for Holly Kernan here on Your Call. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about what makes an effective corporate pressure campaign. On Friday, it's our Media Roundtable weekly discussion with journalists. Going to be focusing on coverage of the U.S. intervention in Iraq and tension between the CIA and the Senate Intelligence Committee. Today, we're talking about tips. We want to hear from you if you are someone who works in a restaurant or other tipped industries, or perhaps you operate a business in a sector where people regularly get tips, or maybe just someone who gives tips. Today is a great time to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're talking about the push to raise the tipped minimum wage, or to actually make it the same as the minimum wage that is being pushed for increases across the country. And also just the practice of tipping. What relationship does it make between workers at restaurants and other businesses and their customers and their employers? And we want to hear your perspective on it. 866-798-8255. Saru, I wanted to follow up on Lynn's comment before the break about the idea of kind of changing the way that we think about tips as not being part of someone's basic wage, but as some kind of, say, hey, you did something really, this was great service, here's something additional. Is that the way you'd like to see people think about it?
Yeah, and I would say I think most people in America do think of it that way. When I've been around the country, did like a 200-city book tour when my book came out, and mostly everywhere, people don't know that there's a lower wage for tipped workers. People are shocked to find out. Generally, people think their tips are on top of a wage that servers and other restaurant workers earn. They're pretty horrified to find that their tips are actually the wage of these workers. And I will say, even my organization, even I, we were under the spell of the Restaurant Association until last year, this idea that there could be a lower wage for tipped workers simply because they earn tips. And that's what the Miller-Harkin bill really reflects, 70%. But something happened over the last year which changed our perspective completely. For one thing, we did the research that I mentioned on the 7 states that have never had a lower wage for tipped workers, and they are in this bucket, as Lynn mentioned, of just having a wage and letting tips be on top of a wage. And they're doing, as I said, better on every measure than the 43 states that have the lower tip minimum wage. That happened. But the second and more horrifying thing that happened was that in every book talk I gave, some woman would come up to me, like Lynn, and say, I'm a lawyer now, I'm an IBM executive, I'm whatever. I used to work in the industry when I was young, and I have to say that I've been sexually harassed recently on the job, but I never did anything about it because it was never as bad as it was when I was a young woman working in restaurants. And with more research as a result of so many women coming forward and telling us this story, we found that sexual harassment in our industry, and by the way, our industry is the single largest source of sexual harassment complaints to the EEOC in the United States. It isn't just two separate things, low wages and a very macho, abusive industry towards women. It is part and parcel of the same thing, because when women are essentially told by managers, dress more sexy, show more cleavage so that you can make more money in tips, and that's what they're encouraged to do, that makes them vulnerable to harassment from not just customers, but also coworkers and management. And in fact, with regard to customers, the women are taught that they really have to put up with whatever a customer might say to them, however they may touch them or treat them or talk to them, because the customer is always right, because the customer is paying their wage, not their employer, which puts them in an incredibly vulnerable situation. So that was the second thing that happened, and really horrific. And the third thing, and sort of the nail on the coffin for us, was Nancy Pelosi came out with her women's economic agenda, and we were working with women's organizations across the country lifting up this idea of we have to eliminate the gender pay equity gap, the fact that women earn 73 cents on the dollar. And we'd be up there in the same breath saying, you know, we need to eliminate women earning 73 cents on to the man's dollar, and we need to legislate minimum wage women at 70% of the overall minimum wage. It made no sense. We realized what we really need is for everybody in America to earn a wage, at least the minimum wage. And then for tips can be on top of that, as they are in California and the six other states. But at a very base level, no woman in America, no worker in America, should be forced to rely on tips for any portion of her base wage.
Sarah, I want to bring in someone who's from a different perspective on this, who's actually taken a step that I think some of us may think about, okay, we change, you know, so that tipping is something that's on top of a living wage or on top of the same minimum wage that's at, you know, for all professions. But Jay Porter, who is a restaurateur, former owner of The Linkery, which was a San Diego restaurant that actually tried to end tips altogether in it. And Jay, I want to welcome you to your call. Right now, I understand you're managing the Half Orange restaurant in Oakland's Fruitvale District, and you're going to be opening up another restaurant in Oakland later this year, I understand, is the plan. Jay, tell us, what made you decide to want to try this experiment with eliminating tips at your restaurant? And why did you, instead of, I mean, you could obviously just you say to people, hey, here's what we're paying our workers. We're paying a living wage. You're free to give something additional. But you actually did something different than that. Tell us why you did it. And how it works.
Okay, yeah, that's like four questions.
I've been waiting for you for a while.
We were faced with an issue at the time in California, and this law has changed due to case law. We were faced with a problem that tipping, while servers could pool tips, they couldn't include the kitchen in that pool at that time. And so a lot of people in our restaurant, including me, felt that the end result was that the compensation was imbalanced between our servers and our cooks. And so for most of the people in the restaurant, we wanted a way to make that more fair, because it makes for a better restaurant, better, ultimately more revenue for everybody when the restaurant's better. So what we did was we switched, rather than allow tips, or rather than, you know, let people decide how much they tip at the end of a meal, we just charged an 18% tip and wouldn't accept any tips beyond that. Our tipping rate at the time had been about 21-22%, so we were giving some money back to our guests. That solved our short-term issue, but we really found there were all these other benefits, including what some of your guests have talked about today, greater professionalization of the job, much less sexual harassment by the customers, really just a really much better, easier place to do our job, because suddenly we were all working in an environment that's just like every other American works in every other industry in the U.S., where, you know, we got paid for our work without having to, as your last guest was saying, you know, without putting the employee in a position where each customer was relying on each customer to pay them, and then, you know, outside of kind of the rules of employment and subjecting them to all sorts of things, including, you know, I don't think you've talked about this yet today, but there's lots of research that shows in a tipped environment, customers, guests who are white receive better service than guests who are people of color, and employees for the same work who are white receive more money for the exact same work than people of color. So, you know, there's all these kinds of things that happen outside of the regular employment system, because this tip system is totally unregulated. So we found all these benefits. We liked working better. It was easier to run the restaurant. We were really stoked on it. As to why we didn't just get rid of tips and not have a service charge, that's just simple math, because somebody looks at your menu, and if they see your prices are 20% higher than a comparable restaurant, they're very likely to just go to that restaurant. I don't think it's kind of wishful thinking that people would say, I'm going to go to this restaurant because they pay really great benefits, or their employees make more money. But, you know, unfortunately, that's just not how it works. And that's why I think, you know, we're all kind of, if those of us who want to see restaurant workers get paid more, we are all relying on the government to, you know, raise the minimum wage and get restaurant workers paid more.
So the model that you adopted is one that exists in a lot of other countries, you know, where there's some built-in gratuity.
Right.
Why do you think more restaurant owners haven't adopted that here?
Well, you know, there's certainly fear of change in every industry. Anybody who's successful in the industry, you know, change is puts that success at risk. And so we were a startup restaurant. We were less than a year old. We weren't particularly high revenue at the time. And, you know, that allowed us to take a risk. And the end result for us was that our restaurant got really popular because we were executing better. Our cooks were more highly paid. Our servers were happier with the work environment, you know, for the most part. And we, you know, we shot up in popularity, and that's why we became kind of an ambassador for this idea. Because, but you know, it would have been hard if we were already in a successful place to implement that. And I think that's why you don't see more established restaurants taking it on. But I can tell you from discussions with people, you know, behind the scenes for years, you know, plenty of operators understand how flawed the tip system is and how much it ultimately costs them in not being able to run an efficient business. But nobody wants to put themselves out there to be the target when you are progressive in some way or take some risk, you know, you become a public figure that isn't always beloved.
I want to bring in some of our listeners into this conversation. I got a listener in Santa Cruz who asked not to give their name, but welcome to the program. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I'm sorry, it's a little scratchy on this end, so I'll
coming
do my
through
best.
Loud and clear.
I was wondering how possibly our economic model for cafes and for restaurants has been built up, perhaps predicated on the assumption that the cost of doing business includes low wages, just sort of how our whole food system is set up in terms of the cost of labor, and whether it is possible to run successful businesses if you are paying someone potentially twice as much or, you know, $3 or $4 more than you're paying them now. I mean, I've been on both ends of it, and it's just interesting to me, you know, when I think about a business like the Olive Garden or some big chain, and I go, yeah, sure, of course you should pay these people more. It's ridiculous. It's not even a living wage. You know, your shareholders are making plenty of profit. You know, share some of that wealth, give people a living wage. But then I think about small business owners that I know, little cafe owners, little mom-and-pop places, and if they... I know what their profit margins are, and their profit margins are small, especially in restaurants. They're small. And I think, okay, well, if you had to double the wage of all of your staff, how could you do that? So I'm just really curious about that.
I'd like to hear both of our guests, how they'd respond to that. Sarah, then Jay.
Yeah. So we have about... Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So we have about 100 restaurant owners across the country who have worked with us to form an alternative restaurant association called RAISE, Restaurants Advancing Industry Standards and Employment. And most of them are tiny restaurant owners who, you know, tiny restaurants that are, you know, employ between, some less than 10 to 10 to, very small restaurants we're talking about across the country, the vast majority of whom have worked it into their business model to provide livable wages and benefits like paid sick days, which is another huge issue in our industry that so many workers work when they're sick because they're forced to. And they've managed to do it. You know, yes, their small businesses do have less profit margins than the huge chains, but they've managed to work it into their business model, and they found tremendous benefits, the kind that Jay talked about, much less turnover, which costs small restaurants and cafes thousands of dollars each year. In fact, we did a huge national study together with Cornell University. We surveyed 1,100 restaurants across the country, restaurant owners, and we found that restaurants could cut their turnover in half by increasing wages and providing benefits, and that turnover cost a restaurant at least $12,000 a year, even a tiny restaurant. And so you're talking about huge savings with regard to employee turnover, employee theft, employee loyalty, productivity, and ability to sell better. We have found for the 100 restaurants we work with across the country, most of which are small, that they have managed to tremendously provide higher wages and better benefits than the average restaurants around them and not increase prices too much, if at all. I'll give it as an example. The Russell Street Deli, which I profile in my book, which is in Detroit, Michigan, which, is in very dire economic straits as a city, but their restaurant is growing. It's doing really well. They don't provide menu items that are extraordinarily expensive. In fact, they have a $5 soup on their menu.
And so, if I could ask, so is part of that about the fact that customers get an understanding that this is that these are establishments that treat their workers better, or is what else is what's going on? Explain why you think that's effective.
That's only part of the picture, and we've had to do a lot of work actually to educate customers. We have an app that tells customers how restaurants are faring on these issues. But really, I think customers get better service at these restaurants. They get better service. The food is better. Everything feels better because the workers are more productive and more happy. They are being treated as the professionals that they strive to be. And so the business is doing really, really well because of the workers are treated well and paid well, not in spite of it. And the menu prices aren't any higher. And I'll just end with one thing on this. If it were true that menu prices had to go way up because of a doubling or tripling in wages, I would just ask you to consider Washington, D.C., which has much higher cost of living than most cities in California, where the tip minimum wage is $2.77, and California, where the wage is $8 across the board, 9, 10 going up, right? I guarantee you menu prices are not higher in Fresno than they are in Washington, D.C. I guarantee you that. I have looked myself at Olive Gardens in both places. Menu prices are not higher, nor are they higher in small restaurants in those places. So somehow California restaurants have managed to live with wage increases and, in fact, work it into their business plan in such a way that they're doing fine. California has the largest and one of the fastest growing restaurant industries in the country.
Jay, you want to add something as someone who's run one of these small businesses about the effects?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that the idea that restaurants should be cheap and food should be cheap enough to go all the time is really a race to the bottom for everybody. It means that restaurant workers get underpaid and treated poorly. It means that farm workers get underpaid and treated poorly. And in the end, it means the customers are getting bad food. And so we need to lose the idea that restaurants should be like, you know, I can eat at them three times a day and it shouldn't cost me anything. I mean, restaurants are hard work, and the producing good food is hard work, even back to the farm. And, you know, I think that we need to be prepared to pay for that. And the only way to make sure that people can afford to pay for that is to make sure that the minimum wage or the wages are high enough that people have some money in their pocket. The other direction we're going is that everybody's poor, but food is cheap and food's horrible. So, you know, like, I don't really, like, I think restaurant prices need to go up. Food prices need to go up. People need to understand that the work that goes into it is valuable. But in order to do that, you know, one restaurant can't unilaterally decide to do that. That's got to happen at a macro level.
That's Jay Porter, former owner of The Linkery, which was a San Diego restaurant that experimented with abolishing tipping. Also with us today for our conversation about the politics and economics of tipping is Sara Jayaraman, co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, as well as being an academic at UC Berkeley and author of Behind the Kitchen Door, which was a study of restaurants. And if you'd like to join this conversation about tipping, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK. Let's go next to Joel in Oakland. Joel, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I thought so far it seemed like you guys are focusing more on restaurant, but there is a big chunk of people also. They do basically drive for Uber. And the assumption is that tip is included, Uber the customer tip is included. And in reality, Uber shares that tip, if it is there, it shares it with the drivers. So I think that needs to be addressed if you can.
So Joel, are you a driver yourself?
I am driving. I would rather be anonymous as much as I can.
Sure. Okay. I understand. But you're just raising the point that sometimes people don't know in other situations where the tips actually end up going. Beyond
well, the system, the Uber just tell the customer, don't tip the driver. The tip is included, and most of the time, when you see it at the end of the trip, it's Uber taking its share as percentage. If the fare, for example, $90, they take $18, which is 20% out of that. So how do you figure out which is the tip, which is the fare, which is overshare? How did they reach that percentage, for example? if my tip is included? And how do I know that they are not taking part of the tip?
Joel, thank you so much for the call. Really appreciate you bringing that perspective. Someone outside of the restaurant industry dealing with tips. Alex in San Francisco, you're our next listener on the program. Welcome to your call. Go ahead.
Email also. I don't know if I gave you my email address.
It sounds like we still have Joel on the line. Alex, are you with us still? Okay, so we're going to just keep the conversation going. So back to you, Saru, kind of talking about this the changing relationship between, you've talked about sexual harassment and the kind of position that a tipped industry puts servers in, specifically at restaurants. How do you want people to kind of rethink what that relationship is and the role of tipping in it? And I think a lot of people who are the people being served, the people leaving the tips, you know, I just wonder how you would try to change their perspective on that.
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry. This is Jay.
I was actually asking Saru. But Jay, you can go ahead if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I have some experience in that. I mean, we definitely found that by removing, there's an element in tipping when the guest is, you know, at the end of their meal is deciding, you know, has withheld some payment till the end. Mm. There's an element that leads the guest to feel that they have some control over the situation, which, you know, studies have shown is actually not really true. And my experience bears that out. Servers are doing the quality of work that they do. But the guest feels they have control, and that, in some cases with some people, that can lead to a really dangerous kind of, physically dangerous, but unpleasant, unfair kind of sexual harassment dynamic where the guest feels that they can have the server do whatever the guest wants. And then the server has to decide, you know, on her end whether or not that's, you know, how far she wants to play along with that in order to keep the business going. And that's really this icky, kind of horrible situation. It's really, it's unfair to the server, and I think in many ways, as she was saying, traumatizing. And I think that by removing that idea that the customer is somehow driving the situation with this, because it's a false idea anyway, to remove that idea that by withholding payment to the end, the customer is controlling the situation, that really removes that whole dynamic from it. And I think that makes it better for the customer and for the server. And I think that's an opportunity that we can all be taking.
And Saru, I was just asking Jay about, you know, how we want to change this relationship, because I think it was interesting hearing, you know, Professor Haley early in the hour talk about, you know, there's one time we were talking about tipping in really elite institutions. Now, this is something totally democratic. Many, many people are on both sides of working in restaurants and being the people tipping people in restaurants. How you would try to change, though, the people who may not be people who've worked in who've been in that position of being a server at a restaurant or working in the back of the house, change their understanding of that relationship when it comes to tipping and when it comes to, you know, paying a living wage to people who are doing that work?
Yeah, I mean, I find that going around the country and even doing polls on this issue in various states, and, you know, we actually have ballot measures and legislation moving in 3 or 4 states across the country to join California and 6 other states to eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers in those places. When we polled in Washington, D.C. to eliminate the 277 wage in D.C. and bring everybody up to the same wage, it was 88% support from among the populace. So I generally find that people in general are in favor of these workers receiving the same wage as everybody else, that people feel their hard-earned money when they leave it in tips shouldn't be a wage, but should be generally on top of a wage, or that's what they think is happening. So I don't think it will take a huge amount of education to get most people in favor of people getting a wage, but what it will take is a tremendous fight that we're engaged in with the Restaurant Association and the Restaurant Association's control over state legislatures, and really convincing state legislators and federal legislators that it's in their best interest to not listen to the NRA and instead listen to the people, who generally believe that women should be treated fairly, that nobody should be sexually harassed on the job, that everybody deserves a wage, that, as Jay said, customers, you know, one of our high road employers in Michigan
I'll just tell you, Paul Sagan is the owner of Zingerman's Restaurants in Ann Arbor, Michigan, huge, very successful, very beloved restaurant owner in Michigan. He said to me the other day, you know, the problem with this system is that it essentially gets customers should decide whether or not a server gets a wage or a wage at all. And I don't think even the customer wants that. So I don't think the populace needs to be convinced, but they do need to be mobilized to demand of our legislators that change happens. And to me, that is a step towards fixing the overall system. The first step has to be getting everybody a base wage, and then over time we can work towards a system like Jay's talking about, just really getting to a place where everybody is treated as a professional and paid as a professional, and one day perhaps eliminating the system altogether. I think part of the resistance, even from workers, is that the mythology that's been put out there, and I think it's evident from at least the last call I heard, is the mythology that's out there is doing this would kill the business. And it all comes from the restaurant. It would kill the restaurant association, kill the business. It would make tips go away, which to your California listeners, I hear that across the country. Well, if we provided the same wage to tipped and non-tipped workers, wouldn't tipping go away? Wouldn't people stop tipping? And I say, I live in the Bay Area. We tip 20% and the wage is the same for tipped and non-tipped workers. We all tip. We don't tip differently because workers earn a base wage that's the same as everybody else. So that's part of the mythology that restaurant workers have been told by the restaurant association. They've been told servers will be replaced by robots, which I just find hilarious because this is a service profession. It's just not going to happen. So I just think there's a lot of mythology out there that needs to be corrected. And then people, we just need, once that mythology can be corrected, we need to demand this change and demand so that our legislators don't fall in the hands of these lobbyists.
Saru Jayaraman is co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United. Thank you so much, Saru, for joining us for the hour. And I want to let folks know that you can go to yourcallradio.org to learn more about their Living Off Tips campaign there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And also great to have with us Jay Porter, former owner of The Linkery, which was a San Diego restaurant that experimented with abolishing tips, and now he's managing the Half Orange in Oakland's Fruitvale District. Jay, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Matt Martin. This is Your Call. Thanks for listening. What makes an effective corporate pressure campaign? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how people power can make big companies change their ways. Walgreens recently bowed to public pressure to remain in the U.S. after considering moving overseas. And Oxfam successfully pushed General Mills to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. What tactics work? How have the emergence of social media and the sheer size of multinationals changed what it takes to win? Join the conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.